You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk is supported by listeners like you. Find out how you can contribute via Patreon or with reviews at monstertalk.org/support. Your contributions, large or small, make a huge difference. Thanks.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
On July 18th, 2021, the Adventures in Poor Taste Sci-Fi Fest conference included a 45-minute segment of my interview with author and comic book artist Stephen R. Bissett. Bissett's probably best known for his work on the Alan Moore run of the DC comic Swamp Thing. Our interview was about Stephen's book, Cryptid Cinema, with a special focus on the little-known touring film used by Roger Patterson to promote and profit from his famous alleged Bigfoot film. What follows is the extended cut of our interview. The interview was video streamed, and if you'd like to watch our discussion rather than just listen to it, you'll find a link to that in the show notes. Be sure to like and share the video on YouTube and social media if you like it. We're working to grow our video footprint, and your engagement through liking and sharing helps that effort.
Monster Talk.
Tonight, I'm just going to say tonight, it's literally a dark and stormy night where I'm at, so this is fantastic. I want to say welcome to Steve Bissett to the Adventures in Poor Taste Sci-Fi Fest. So this is the first time this has happened. I'm very excited about being a part of it, so. You're Steve Bissett. Just briefly, I'm Blake Smith from the podcast Monster Talk, and I also do a podcast called In Research Of, where a colleague of mine and I watch the old TV show In Search Of and sort of add in the missing science.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
How have we not met before?
I know, it's crazy.
You know, and then this is like amazing. So,
and then I have a show called, I cleverly titled it, The Horror Podcast, where I talk about old horror movies. So yeah, that's, but we're here to talk about your work, especially this book, Cryptid Cinema, and you also have a new book coming out. But could you introduce yourself to the audience?
Hi, folks. I'm Steve Bissett. I'm a born and raised Vermonter, still living in Vermont. I primarily cut my teeth in the pop culture as a cartoonist working in the comics industry. I'm best known for the work I did back in the 1980s on DC Comics Swamp Thing. I collaborated with Alan Moore, John Todleben, Rick Veitch, and a number of other folks on Swamp Thing for about a 5-year period back in the 80s. And that work is still in print to this day, all around the world. So, but my first love is, my first love is dinosaurs. My first love is monsters. And I have been writing about that first love since the 1980s. The late, great Chaz Ballin was a friend of mine. He invited me to start contributing reviews to his fanzine, Deep Red, back in, God, late 80s, very early 90s. And I've been writing about horror movies, monster movies, science fiction films, fantasy films, and a lot of comics history ever since. Fantastic. I just retired from a 15-year stint teaching at the Center for Cartoon Studies. So now I'm, quote, retired, unquote.
Do you find yourself still busy? That's like
more busy. I mean, now I'm able to work on, you know, projects like these and Cryptid Cinema. I don't have to table that while I do my, you know, primary bread and butter work as a teacher.
I have to ask. So you've got a 700-page book about The Brood.
Yeah.
So are you a big Cronenberg fan? Or a huge Cronenberg fan?
Well, no, you know, it's that I love all cinema, and I love all comics and graphic novels, and the way I look at films and comics, you know, this book is one attempt to write about one movie that's near and dear to me. I love Cronenberg's work, but The Brood was a movie that really was important to me. Played an important role in my life at a certain point, which I get into in the book. The book I just turned in to my book designer, the great Tim Paxton, who designed Cryptid Cinema, the first volume, which we'll be talking about, Blake, is a similar deep dive into a single movie, The Legend of Boggy Creek.
Yeah.
1972. And I won't say that I could do a book of this magnitude about any film or about any comic, but when a movie hits a nerve with me, if a graphic novel really you know, strikes me, it hits on so many levels that it's hard for me to, you know, talk in sound bites about it.
Yeah,
because the connections, the pop cultural connections, the cultural connections are spread so far and they go so deep. And that depth and that vastness is what fascinates me about pop culture. And it's exactly the thing that most books ignore.
I wanted to show a couple of layout pages. The
the work that Tim Paxton did.
This is such a nifty book. The layout feels very much like a 1960s or 1970s monster mag. So when I picked it up, I mean, I ordered it based on the title because as a huge fan of cryptozoology and someone who's looked at this stuff my whole life, I thought, well, that sounds like a title I have to have. And then when I got it and opened it up, I felt like I had like turned seven again. You know, like my parents were super conservative and they wouldn't let me near the, you know, I couldn't go look at Fangoria or that kind of thing. So I would sneak off and look at Starlog and Fangoria and famous monsters and that sort of thing.
Our model, and Tim Paxton and I are roughly the same age. I was born in 1955. So we're of the monster kid generation. We grew up with famous monsters. We grew up with the Aurora model kits. You know, I was seven when those hit the market.
Castle of Frankenstein.
Okay. And I was going to say Castle of Frankenstein, the greatest of all 1960s newsstand monster magazines, was our model for Cryptid Cinema.
There you go.
In terms of design. And also in terms of how it's conceptually put together, not so much Calvin T. Beck, who was the editor publisher, but more the writers like the late Bob Stewart, and that's spelled B-H-O-B Stewart.
Yeah, and, I've seen that
and
name.
And Joe Dante Jr. I mean, they really taught me how to think about and how to write about cinema. And that all came from Castle of Frankenstein. And that's why Cryptid Cinema is what it is.
You know, so we just did an episode yesterday. We recorded about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre because we're doing a series called Debased on a True Story, where we're looking at the whatever the facts are behind the legends, you know, that sort of thing. And of course, everybody says Robert Bloch based Norman Bates on Ed Gein, the Minnesota killer.
Also based him on Calvin T. Beck.
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say. That's funny.
Not just Calvin, but also Calvin's mother.
Yes, exactly. So. That is such an amazing story. I found it through Tom Weaver's blog and read all about it. And I was like, oh, so that's the Astounding B-Movie Monster Archive. So I have to say, if anybody's listening to this, you haven't read that story, you need to read it. It's really interesting. So.
Yeah, and Robert Bloch wrote about it in science fiction fanzines. I've tracked down a couple of reprint editions. I may be able to reach one right here. Yes, here we go. This is Robert Bloch's The Eighth Stage of Fandom. This is a book that was put together in, I'd say, the mid-60s, collecting some of his fanzine essays for science fiction fanzines. Because Bloch was writing for science fiction fanzines going back to the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
And in here is an essay about Calvin T. Beck, Calvin T. Beck's mother, and Psycho by Robert Bloch.
I need to read that. That is fantastic. Okay. I found this out about a month ago, 2 months ago, and it's just been stuck in my head. I want to know more.
So. Well, get your hands on, these are not plugs that I benefit from in any way. So please don't think of it that way. I just love sharing information. Dick Clemenson, Richard Clemenson, editor publisher of Little Shop of Horror, one of the great fanzines dedicated to Hammer Films, has been running a series of articles in each new issue about some aspect of Monster Magazine culture. And he reprinted with permission Ted White, the science fiction author and editor's essay about visiting Calvin Beck's home and working on laying out an issue of Castle of Frankenstein.
Wow.
So if you want to know more, Blake, and that was like four issues ago of Little Shop of Horrors.
I would like to read that for multiple reasons.
Yeah,
for
one thing, I'm
old enough that I got into writing in print right at the time when the switch was being made to digital. So my original work in high school, in my high school newspaper, we would like go and they would print out the sheets and we would do the wax layout, right? You know, lay it down.
Using the old waxers.
Exactly. And then by the time I got to college, they had started switching to using Macs. And so I'm fascinated by the way that zines and magazines were done back then. I think maybe the sort of the line between professionals and amateurs was a little bit blurry, and it kind of is now in some ways. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but those techniques that fanzine editors were using, certainly by the 70s and 80s, were almost identical to how professional magazines were put together. Local newspapers, you know, the free weeklies that every pocket of America has in some way, shape or form, put together the same way.
And you can see it. If you go, like I do a lot of newspapers.com archive research for the In Search of Stuffs, all those articles in the 70s, are relevant to the show. But you can see it in the local papers, like especially around, they didn't put a lot of effort into the TV lineup and the movie ads.
Yeah, they're just throwing that stuff.
Yeah. You can see things are askew. You know, it's I love it. It feels very refreshing to see how things used to be done.
So. That's the feeling we wanted to get in Cryptid Cinema.
Yeah.
Right.
You did. Success.
Tim does incredibly professional layouts and designs, but Tim totally gets. You know, the Tim and I are going through the stage now with the second Cryptid Cinema book, which is called Cryptid Cinema, The Boggy Creek Bequest.
Cryptid Cinema 2, Electric Boggaloo.
That'll be the Canon Films issue. So, the second one is called Cryptid Cinema, The Boggy Creek Bequest.
That'll be fantastic.
We're at the same... We're still feeling out how are we going to shape the material. I've turned in all the text material, which is massive. We may have to break this into two volumes that will come out at the same time because there is a lot of material in this volume. But we're feeling out what it's going to be. Now, that first book, the one that you just held up that we'll be talking about primarily here, we knew we wanted it to look and feel like Castle Frankenstein. That was our conscious model. What was harder for me to articulate originally to Tim was that I saw the book as sort of conceptual origami. Like I wanted the book to kind of fold around the reader's mind, regardless of what order you read it in.
There you go.
Because it's not a linear book. the first cryptids, I ended up writing the books backwards. What is going to be the third volume next year should have been the first. But I, you know, I was just starting. I was just beginning to feel my way around, okay, what is cryptid cinema? So this first book is sort of putting the boundary lines up. And some people justifiably right from the start complain that some of the stuff I wrote about aren't classic cryptozoology, right?
Yes. Because
my argument is cryptid cinema, like horror cinema, like all genres in cinema, is quite diverse. It's quite big. And I was trying to hit the furthest reaches of these are the things that sort of define the boundaries, the parameters of what I think cryptid cinema is. And this second book, which is focused primarily on The Legend of Boggy Creek, the 1972 Charles B. Pierce film, is just about one movie and what it spawned, what it caused, what the legacy that followed The Legend of Boggy Creek is. Because, and so it's a more focused book than that first volume. The first volume is like a shotgun blast of Monster Magazine goodness, you know?
Yes, yeah. In a good way, yeah.
and it was also about, you know, there's a lot of films that I, like, you know, do films about urban legends fit? Well, that's why my long write-up of this obscure Elmira, New York shot independent movie, The Glasshead, is in the first book. What about H.P. Lovecraft? You know, I mean, is when H.P. Lovecraft referred to the Yeti for one of the first times in popular American fiction, he wasn't referring to the classical Yeti that you and I think of today. He was linking it with these creatures from beyond the stars and putting it in the context of these sort of crustaceans that show up in Vermont in his story, Whisper in the Darkness. But he's talking about the Yeti. He is referring to lore that in the late 1920s was pretty obscure.
Yeah.
It was not known the way it was in the 1950s, where it had entered the popular imagination. So, you know, I was testing the boundaries. A lot of people argued with me about including Equinox, the 1970 film Equinox, in there. But, you know, I got a whole stack of paperbacks over here in my library from the 1970s of books that mash up UFO sightings and Bigfoot sightings. You know, there's this weird blurring that happened in cryptozoology in the late 60s and throughout the 70s.
Yeah.
Were they occult? Were they from another dimension?
Oh, that's not gone. Gone. Yeah.
Well, John Keel was one of the proponents of the dimension theory. And now it's like, so that first book was really about, let me have some fun talking about the films that are at the far edges. Let me hit the grace notes. You know, I made sure Creature from the Black Lagoon, King Kong, the classic Bigfoot movies, Legend of Boggy Creek, they're all mentioned and pictured in cryptid cinema. But the focus really begins with the second volume. The first book is meant to be a fun monster magazine, you know?
Yeah, and it is. It is. I got the book, and almost immediately, just after opening up, dropped it and like ran and wrote to a bunch of my friends in the monster world. It was like, you got to get this book. Even if you don't read it, you're just going to want to look at it. It's very well. It's just, it was captivating. So yeah. Well, but I do want to talk about, there's a lot of really cool stuff in here.
Yeah.
But in the middle of all this gorgeous monster beauty, there's this wonderful essay about one of the most obscure pieces of cinema that people just don't know about. They think they do. And that is Bigfoot, America's Abominable Snowman, which was the touring film. You could actually talk about this more than me, I think, or at least probably more cogently. Everybody knows the Patterson-Gimlin film as being this little tiny clip of footage. But Patterson and Gimlin, when they made this movie, they actually took it on tour and they did something called four-walling. And this would be, they rented the cinemas and then they took the ticket sales. And I think from what I've heard, they made quite a bit of money, but they've got this Bigfoot, America's Abominable Snowman. What was that? I mean, I know, but explain to the audience.
I can tell you exactly what it is. Yeah. I'm scrolling through my, here we go. Now, what, in 1960, 7. Mysterious film footage was shot in California that is still argued about to this day by Patterson and Gimlin. And it's referred to as the Patterson-Gimlin footage. And it's a few minutes, few seconds, really.
Really, yeah.
Shaky, you are there, cinema verite of a Sasquatch, female Sasquatch, looking over her shoulder and walking away. That's all that happens in this shaky footage. After they had this footage, and you and I can discuss or we can ignore the controversy surrounding the footage. That's your call. It's your interview.
Let's skip it for now.
We'll skip it for now. Let's just say the footage existed. And
exactly.
Then the question was, what are they going to do with it?
Yes. Okay?
So what ended up happening is there's a lot of erroneous information out there, including on Wikipedia, IMDb, so on and so forth. Other than regional or national news broadcasts that showed snippets of that footage when it was relatively new. So we're talking about end of 67, beginning of 68. The first licensed use of that footage was in a BBC Two TV special called Bigfoot, America's Abominable Snowman. And it was broadcast once in England, Saturday, July 27th, 1968. And some of my British friends have verified that for me. People like Kim Newman and Jonathan Rigby, you know, genre specialists who keep track of all these things like TV listings and so on.
Yeah.
So they nailed it for me. We didn't know whether it had ever been shown. They nailed it. It was shown Saturday, July 27th, 1968. And it was the first nonfiction, non-newscast Sasquatch TV special anywhere in the world, as far as I know. So it was also the first licensed use of the Patterson-Gimlin film, meaning BBC Two paid something to Patterson-Gimlin and their partner. And it was hosted by Dr. John Napier, who is the curator of mammals at Smithsonian Institute. And it included in its half-hour interview format a guest interview with Ivan T. Sanderson, the man who wrote the book on the Abominable Snowman in the early 60s. Okay. It was only shown once in the UK, never shown in America. Now, we don't know the particulars of the deal, and it's still a mystery. No paperwork has turned up. Lauren Coleman has the actual reel of the film in the collection of the International Cryptozoology Museum in Portland, Maine. And it was Lauren Coleman who very kindly allowed me to screen the film. Now, the print he has does not have the padding or the introduction material that Patterson added to the movie for their roadshow. One of the other museums that has a print, and that's all covered in Cryptid Cinema. There's a page where I actually show the photographs of their reels, you know, the cans of film. They may have prints that have that additional footage. I would love to see it.
Me too.
Now, that deal, whatever the contractual arrangement was with BBC Two, included Patterson getting a copy of that BBC Two documentary, okay? And perhaps more than one print of it. He either had more than one print or he had a print that he was able to strike other prints off of.
Right, right.
Because the numbers vary, but, you know, he and his partner had a number of prints that they were traveling around, primarily the northwestern states.
That was Diatley, his brother-in-law, I think.
Is it? Yeah, it was his brother-in-law, Diatley. I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
Me either.
Being from Duxbury, Vermont, don't trust my pronunciation of any name here. So what they were doing, you were right when you said they were four-walling. And four-walling was a reference to a practice that goes back to the silent era, where a producer could come in or a distributor could come in and rent the theater space. They rent all four walls. They collect the box office, the theater keeps all the concession. Okay. And that practice goes back to the old states' rights system of distribution that used to be how feature films were distributed throughout the U.S. and in the provinces in Canada.
I think anybody interested in Bigfoot cinema, you're going to know Sun Classic, and they were masters.
Four-walling was a venerable practice. I mean,
yeah.
Before Sun Classics, before Patterson, going back to the silent era, people would travel to the Arctic, right? They'd go to the North Pole.
Oh, I've seen that. Yeah, yeah, I've seen those adventure films.
They'd come back with film footage of that those travels, and they would rent theater spaces, auditoriums, public halls, present a lecture, show the film, and that essentially was the beginning of four-walling.
In fact, I just found out that practice, the early practice, fairly recently, and it suddenly King Kong makes a lot more sense.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. It gives you a whole lot more context to the world that they were kind of rolling into.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Because the men who made King Kong, Marion C. Cooper and Ernest B. Schoensack, they had done that with their pseudo documentaries like Grass and another feature called Chang. And it was hard to convince, you know, the studios would look at the films and go, we can't sell that. So four-walling became a way of not just making money that you pocketed. It was also a way of proving to the studios, this has an audience out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, even big shots, like Walt Disney made the first true life adventure nature film, which was, I believe, Beaver Valley.
Steve asked me to insert this quick correction. Seal Island in 1948 was the first of the true life adventures from Disney. And this was the one that Disney had to four-wall to sell to RKO, or at least to prove the concept. Beaver Valley was 1958, and that was the second of these kind of features. And by this time, RKO was on board. And back to the show.
And RKO, the distributor of King Kong, was distributing Disney's films, and he showed them his true life adventure, and they went, nah. So what Disney did is he rented four-walled a theater space, and it did so well that RKO changed their mind and went, oh. And, you know, the way it changes their mind is they go, oh, there's money to be made.
Exactly, here. Yeah.
So Patterson was doing that. Patterson and his brother-in-law were doing that with their slightly padded version of Bigfoot, America's an Abominable Snowman. Now, it was a half-hour program. The BBC Two production is half an hour long, 30 minutes. So they were padding it out to what, 45 minutes, an hour? I'm not sure. Until I see it, I don't know.
Yeah. I see there was a talk. I've seen pictures.
They had a talk.
Yeah, yeah.
They gave a lecture. I mean, they went right back to the prototype from the early 1900s of, you know, explorer goes to Africa, shoots footage in Africa, comes back. No studio wants it. He roadshows it. That's exactly what Patterson was doing.
Gimlin was out at this point, right? They'd had some kind of falling out.
Yeah, or Gimlin wasn't interested. I mean, it's a lot of work. You know, you got to schlep this stuff around the country. You've got to put it, you know, typically.
You got to run ads, a lot of advertising.
You got to do the advertising beforehand. Yeah. You know, this is a variation of how exploitation cinema classically worked. You know, guys like Kroger Babb with one of the biggest moneymakers in American cinema history was a movie called Mom and Dad. It was like a sex film that ended with an actual childbirth on camera. You know, which was the only way most Americans saw a woman's breasts and vagina for the first time on a screen. And they were schlepping the prints of Mom and Dad around in their car, in the trunk of their car. They'd show up at the theater, show segregated shows, men only, women only, and then they were out of town before the police could show up. So that's what Patterson was doing. You know, Patterson and his brother-in-law, where they would target a community, figure out where they're going to show it. And it might not be in a movie theater. It might be at the high school auditorium. It might be at the local town hall. And they would show the film, do their talk. And Patterson also printed up his book, his famous book, one of the first books on Bigfoot published in America. And he would sell those and then they go on to the next town. They made a lot of money, you know, and it and when you're pocketing that money, it's cash that you're picking up at the box office. It feels like a lot of money. But 6 months in, that gets pretty old, you know.
Yeah.
It's not that different from being a band and you're touring, right? Or it's that different from being a live theater troupe and you're touring. Yeah, you don't have to do the full performance every night, but it's still a horse and pony show that you're trotting out, or in this case, a Sasquatch and pony show you're trotting out. That played through 1969, perhaps early 1970. Part of the plan was the roadshow was initially going to be, let's prove this works, but then let's, you know, strike a deal with one of these nature film distributors, and then they can take it over. Well, that plan went south when they actually started getting the money from the box office, and it's like, well, we don't want to share this. Once it had run its course, and Patterson also, I believe, was ill with some form of cancer. I
mean, right.
His health was suffering. For whatever reason, once it ran its course, they had proven there was an audience for these films, but other forces had come to play. And the studio they had talked to was one of a number of outfits that were roadshowing these hunting and these wilderness nature documentaries. And those movies were making big bucks at the end of the 60s. Movies like Vanishing Wilderness, you know, they were making big money. And they ended up buying, they did license the footage from Patterson and his, and perhaps his brother-in-law was still a partner at that point. I'm not sure as yet. But they ended up just running it as like a 15-minute short that was called Bigfoot, before a film they had picked up from the National Film Board of Canada on wolves, actually a very excellent film called Cry of the Wild, about wolves. And that's where the Patterson-Gimlin film was first played theatrically in the United States, was as the short before Cry of the Wild.
Wow. So I guess that's fantastic. And I don't think people understand, or I mean, it seems like almost a forgotten film. And I think there's what, 5 copies left?
Yeah. And here's the problem. It is a problem, right? If BBC Two, the current incarnation of BBC, knew that those prints existed, they'd be saying, we want that back, right? Nobody knows what the deal was with Patterson. Yeah. Patterson's dead. And there's a lot of legal quagmire around that. And I've been told by a number of, I've been doing bonus feature work for a number of Blu-ray labels over the past year. And it's a lot of fun. And
I bet.
I really enjoy it.
I do that for free with my kids, but you know.
There you go. Well, but the rights.
Shut up, we're watching the movie.
But the rights issues associated with that kind of thing can be really sticky.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it has become a lost film. We know there's some prints out there. And I can say that at least one of the institutions that has a print put feelers out and then pulled them right back, because it's like they're not in the business of distributing film. And that can get very expensive very quickly.
Well, they have a deep catalog of stuff that I would be happy to pay for. They don't stream or make available anywhere. So,
The question is, I mean, BBC, you know, as we all, if you're a Doctor Who fan, you know, BBC like destroyed a lot of their legacy. You know, there are lost episodes. Oh, appropriate to the subject we're discussing. The first of the Abominable Snowman Doctor Who story arcs is gone. That's among the missing episodes from Doctor Who.
I do have the novelization.
The novelization is out there. That's what I read as well to get my handles on it. But, you know, so this stuff is, it's real legal quicksand. I keep hoping that something might change in that regard. But having been able to listen to Pamela Pierce Barcelou, who inherited saw to resurrecting and restoring her father's film, The Legend of Boggy Creek, that process cost her tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And none of these museums are in a position they don't have an endowment that allows them to go, right, here's the $100,000 we'll set aside to try to bring the long lost half hour or 1 hour or 45 minute Bigfoot America's Abominable Snowman to market, much as you and I would love that.
I would pay. I'd be happy to. Exactly. I'd love to have a copy. Now, I did see someone seems to have segments of it on YouTube, or that's what certainly looks like it.
Well, when I was able to watch the film, and I was permitted to watch it quite closely and spend time with it, I have prepared a full transcript of the BBC Two production that will be published in the third Cryptid Cinema volume. It'll be a part of the chapter on the films of the 60s. So I will be providing as close as I can as a writer, you know, the experience to interested readers like yourself, Blake. So,
but I have,
and okay, it is so a full transcription from beginning to end of everything.
This is a huge
there.
Public service. I appreciate it. And I will happily, I would have bought the next copy anyway.
Yeah. And it is a fact. I mean, it is a classic piece of cryptozoological pop culture. I mean, it's a really important piece of work, and thank God it has been preserved in a number of museums, for their own purposes. Some of those museums have transferred it to DVD-R, but they cannot loan it out. They cannot sell it. You know, they cannot lease it. So they're at least trying to see to preserving the content for the ages. Yeah. But, you know, the museums just aren't set up for this kind of thing. If there's any underfunded branch of museums in North America, it's cryptozoological museums.
Yeah.
You know, clearly what Charles B. Pierce started with The Legend of Augie Creek has taken over and permeated our pop culture in ways that were unimaginable in 1970.
Well, I mean, he's certainly got some room in my head that won't be leased to anyone else. I got,
you know, in the second book, I really try to get into how it's hard to communicate to someone in the year 2021, how pioneering that film was in 1972.
You've seen the new restoration.
The new restoration is glorious. I mean, and it's not just the fact that, you know, Pamela Pierce and the Eastman House did a proper job of curating, working with Technicolor and Technoscope and lavishing the same attention on the audio track as well. The Jaime Mendoza Nava soundtrack, not just the music, but the whole oral landscape.
Phenomenal.
What's hard to describe is it's one of those things like, you know, there was cinema before King Kong and there was cinema after King Kong.
Right.
And
right.
We cannot imagine what it was like. It is not possible for us to even imagine what it was like in 1933 to experience that for the first time.
I got to hear Ray Harryhausen and Ray Bradbury talk about how seeing that film changed their life.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And you know, talking about other genres, I mean, you know, there were Westerns before John Ford's Stagecoach.
Yes.
And there were Westerns after John Ford's Stagecoach, but there's no way to put yourself back in what it was like in 1939 to experience Stagecoach. And in my lifetime, how old are you, Blake?
I am 51.
Okay. I'm 66. In my lifetime, I experienced Night of the Living Dead.
Nice.
And there was cinema before Night of the Living Dead, and there was cinema after Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
And I want to put it to your listeners, the people viewing, the people with us in this, you know, venue. The Legend of Boggy Creek was almost that landscape-altering of film. In a very modest way. And part of what I love about late 60s, early 70s independent film is there was a lot of that shit happening, right? No studio saw Easy Rider coming. Columbia lucked into picking it up and benefited from the millions and millions of dollars it generated in theaters. But there's no way a motion picture studio like MGM, 20th Century Fox, or Columbia Pictures would have made Easy Rider. The same goes for Night of the Living Dead, Legend of Boggy Creek, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Eraserhead later in the 70s. You know, the films that altered the cinema landscape, the films that changed everything about our how our even our imaginations functioned as individuals.
Yeah.
Came out of nowhere. They came out of the woodwork. And one of those was that little movie shot in Texarkana with a rented Technoscope camera by a guy who had hosted a kiddie show and ran an advertising firm who had the wherewithal to go, I'm going to make this movie. And it was a crazy movie that he made because it was sort of like a Disney nature documentary, right?
Yep.
It was sort of like the wilderness adventure independent films that were everywhere at that time. And it was sort of a monster movie, but it wasn't any of those things. He put together things that shouldn't have worked together, you know? Like, why have two songs in a monster movie? Like, why do that? When you think about it, my generation, and you probably got a taste of it growing up, we grew up with all these, you know, Disney True Life Adventures narrated by Rex Allen and Tex Ritter, and there'd be a song. And so Charles Pierce went, okay, I'm going to have a couple songs, right? Because this is like folksy, right? This is about the people. And that's the other thing that made it work is really that movie is about a place and a time and the people who live there. The monster is sort of the planet with the gravitational pull for the whole thing. But what made that movie sing, I saw it when it opened at the Paramount Theater in Barrie, Vermont, up here in New England. And when we saw that movie, even though they were speaking with accents that were not our Vermont accents, we recognized those people. We recognized those lifestyles. We were poor. You know, we didn't have a pot to piss in. And what was amazing about that film is it was one of the first films to go, you don't have to go to Skull Island to find a weird critter.
Yeah.
It's out by your laundry right now.
It might reach right in your window.
Yeah. It might grab you while you're taking a dump.
Yeah.
You know? And that was a revelatory experience back then. It really was.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget how loud the audience was screaming by that last sequence, you know, with the assault on the house. I mean, it really worked. It really worked.
No, it did. It's a scare that haunted me for decades.
But it wasn't the scare. You know what the scare did? The scare is what had people go home and talk about the movie.
Yeah.
And it was word of mouth that, like all these films I'm mentioning, it was word of mouth that propelled it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
It was distributed by this outfit, Howco International, that if you look at, go ahead and look online at other films from the 50s and 60s that Howco International distributed. I'll give you some titles. The Brain from Planet Arouse, Teenage Monster, Night of Bloody Horror. Now you look at their ads and it's like classic old science fiction monster movie ads, you know, lurid ads. The ad that Charles Pierce and Jim Ball, who was his partner in the advertising firm, And the artist I hired, Ralph McQuarrie, who did the painting, that they put together was the antithesis of how Halco International had sold every other movie they'd ever released. It was the image, the title, and three words, a true story, and the credits. That was the promotion for Legend of Boggy Creek. They had a great radio spot, and they did sell it with TV spots once the film was out there and began to rack up earnings at the box office. It was sold in a way that no other monster movie had certainly ever been sold, and it was sold in a way that no nature documentary had ever been sold. It was something new. We had never even seen a true crime movie sold that way.
Speaking of influential, I noticed I've been watching a lot of Bigfoot movies.
To do a
bonus feature for it. Well, it all started. I was going to go to a convention and do a talk. I was on a panel that was going to be about Bigfoot movies, and I thought, well, I'll go watch all four. You know,
oh,
and
no,
I
was like, hundreds of them now.
There's over 200 listed on IMDb, and counting. They're still coming out.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But watch, I've been back. I went old, and after Boggy Creek, so many of the Bigfoot movies have either a documentary or pseudo documentary sort of style, and they all have a song, and often terribly catchy. Not a Crabtree catchy, but catchy. So. So that pattern, I'd love to just put together a playlist on Spotify, but a lot of these aren't available, of just Bigfoot songs from Bigfoot cinema. So.
My son, Danny, who is a musician, among many other things, has been working on just that kind of project. And for the third Cryptid Cinema book, we're going to put together sort of an overview of what LPs and 45s were released, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like, a number of them, you know. There's
Sasquatch, The Legend of Bigfoot. They four-walled that one. It came to my hometown. I didn't buy it, but they were selling an album that had all the tracks on it.
Don't you wish you'd bought it.
I was poor.
What can you do? I mean, there's a lot of that stuff out there. And that all started with Legend of Boggy Creek, you know. It all started there. There was one Bigfoot movie, you know, we've talked about Bigfoot, America's Abominable Snowman. It was the first documentary that made its way from BBC Two over to America and was roadshowed in 1969, early 70. 1970 was the first narrative fiction film that sold itself as a Bigfoot movie because the title was Bigfoot. depending on your taste, I mean, let's get down and dirty. Given the context of this panel, we're supposed to be talking about bad taste films, correct?
That I think that's right there in the brain.
Well,
right?
Bigfoot 1970 fits right in there.
That's if I remember correctly, that's Bigfoot, it mates with anything. Is that the tagline?
Well, that's one of the taglines.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know,
this is Robert Mitchum's son. Is that?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Mitchum's brother is in it, right?
Yeah,
with John Carradine.
Yes. He's playing the greasy sales guy, the assistant to John Carradine's traveling salesman.
Joy Lansing. I mean, it has an amazing exploitation cast.
Very talented. She was, and
it is a film about miscegenation. The whole premise of that 1970 Bigfoot movie is they're mating with human women. In fact, there's a little Bigfoot.
Yes, there is.
Loathed by the other Bigfoots because it's part human, part Bigfoot, right?
Yeah.
Now, this whole miscegenation theme goes way back, right?
Yeah, well, I'm from Georgia. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I've been reading a lot of early science fiction hominid stories, going back to the late 1800s, early 1900s. And the whole miscegenation theme of, you know, hairy jungle beasts that aren't gorillas, you know, wanting to mate with humans or having mated with humans, that was popping up in short stories back at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And it was already sort of in the DNA. And if you're just talking about Bigfoot movies, take a look at the 1950s Yeti movies. One of the first American Abominable Snowman movies came out in 1956. It was made by Jerry Warren, an infamous low-budget filmmaker who had made some of the most stupefying movies ever made. It's his best movie. And it's called Man Beast. And the whole premise of Man Beast is there's an expedition going up into the Himalayas trying to find a lost expedition, a brother who has disappeared. And the guide who is leading them into the Himalayas, it turns out, is part Yeti, part human. And he's leading them up there so that he can dispose of the men on the expedition and save and breed with the woman, the sole woman who's part of the expedition. That's 1956. Okay.
Wow.
So by the time we get to 1970 with the movie called Bigfoot, it's in the genetic, you know, it's in the genetic code of these cryptid movies. And part of why I talk about cryptid cinema as a genre isn't that part of the impetus of King Kong? Isn't that what drives the Creature from the Black Lagoon, right? This whole threat of and allure of interspecies.
Well, that's you included the Dunwich Horror.
Oh yeah, because then, Lovecraft was right
Lovecraft's
on board.
Right up in all that. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, right out there, you know.
Yeah. So.
And what is the Dunwich Horror? It's two brothers who are the result of miscegenation between some being from the other side and a mortal woman. And one of them is more like a human being, Wilbur. And the other one that we don't see until the end of the story looks more like its father is the famous tagline of the story, you know. Yeah, that's a lot of what drives cryptid cinema. Also, I would argue, you know, that is the unsavory aspect of the genre, because it really also has to do with racist and xenophobic attitudes that still permeate this culture to this day.
Yeah.
Not the way they used to. I mean, you know, you never, ever would have, you just wouldn't have seen a film as explicit as, say, Night of the Demon, which was made in 1980. That's a Bigfoot movie you have to see.
Oh, I've seen it. Yeah. Okay. I've covered it for my bonus material. That is a seriously crazy film. I've argued, though, I mean, it probably the most Lovecraftian Bigfoot movie ever made, as near as I can tell. So I mean,
I agree. Until you get to Demon Warp.
Yeah, I haven't got the Demon Warp yet.
Oh yeah, Demon Warp takes it to
it is
another
in my
whole
list.
Level.
So. Yeah, okay.
But yeah, Night of the Demon is very much a Lovecraftian spin on the Northern California Sasquatch lore. About it.
I liked it. I mean, people warned me, you won't like this movie. It's a piece of trash. I'm like, I like a lot of trash. It was pretty good.
It was an amazing. I mean, that was one of those movies I first saw on VHS while binging with friends, where you'd go to the video store, rent like five movies you'd never heard of.
Yeah.
And that was one of the ones that our jaws were dropping and we were we can't believe we're.
I managed to get my wife to watch it with me, which, she just kept hearing me say, "Oh my God, I can't believe this is that." It's like, "Are you kidding me?" And she's like, "Just rewind it. I'll watch it with you." So she sat down and we watched the whole thing. It's like, it was great. So
I think
that and Samurai Cop are like the two most recent. Let's call them trash cinema, but very engaging cinema. So
you know, out of all those 1970s Bigfoot movies that followed, most of them made the same mistake that all the films before Legend of Boggy Creek made, which is the beauty of Legend of Boggy Creek was you don't have to go anywhere. These things are going to show up in your backyard.
Yeah.
Almost every Bigfoot movie that followed 2 to 3 years after Legend of Boggy Creek made the mistake of embracing the old, let's go on an expedition, right? And the big difference is extraordinary people get horses and donkeys and go camping out in the wilderness looking for creatures. The beauty of Legend of Boggy Creek is ordinary people had that happen to them, right? And as soon as you make the decision, I'm going to go in the woods and just camp for 3 months in hopes of seeing Bigfoot, you are no longer an ordinary person.
That's true. No, that's a really interesting point. I like that.
And they turned them into expedition films all over again, which is what Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Lost World was in 1912, and when they filmed it in 1925, and that's what King Kong was in 1933, and that's what The Creature from the Black Lagoon was in 1953, blah, blah, blah. And the big difference was Legend of Boggy Creek disposed of all that. They got rid of all those creaky old narrative templates. But genre works in such a way that when a movie punches a hole in a genre and creates something new, blazes a new path, a new way of telling a story, most people who follow, consciously or unconsciously, go back to the old template. And that's part of why those mid-70s Bigfoot movies really aren't much fun. You know, they're sort of like bad Westerns that have a minute, if that, of a monster at the end, right?
Yeah.
And it's not until my favorite of the ones that followed is The Creature from Black Lake.
Oh, that is a good one. Yeah.
And it's a really good one. It, you know, the premise is two college students are going to go down south and go where there's been sightings of monsters. And that, okay, they're not on an expedition. You know, college students do that kind of stuff and always have. And so it sort of had its cake and ate it too. And it's actually a really entertaining little
budget. It's solid. It's a solid film.
Right. Yeah, great performances. Yeah.
So many character actors. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Jackie Lamb.
Yeah.
It's like you've got like half of Sam Peckinpah's entourage there in Creature from Black Lake. So that's the one I would recommend. I would recommend Creature from Black Lake and Night of the Demon to anybody who's curious about, you know, what followed Legend of Boggy Creek that stood out. Because most of the others don't. I mean, there's ones like Cry Wilderness, which is a really awful movie, but it's entertaining as an awful movie. That's one with the little boy who sees Bigfoot and sort of bonds with it. And, you know, but it's entertaining for all the wrong reasons, as opposed to Creature from Black Lake and Night of the Demon, which are entertaining for all the right reasons.
Yeah, very much so. Well, I hope to get to all those. I don't know how I'll manage, but I'm creeping through my 200. So let me
give you some recommendations. May I?
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be great.
Okay. Here's sort of my, you know, my favorites of the genre. As I mentioned at the end of Cryptid Cinema, you know, my favorite cryptid film when I was finishing that book was Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water.
That's a good one. Yeah.
And it's the only one other than Legend of Boggy Creek that my wife has ever watched and that she enjoyed.
So I understand. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful film. I mean,
it's a brilliant movie.
Far more beautiful than I think Lovecraft would have ever expected anything like that to be.
Yeah. But what was interesting to me, and this always happens, is when it was embraced by the world at large, a lot of my most diehard genre friends despised it. Like they all found things wrong with it. And to me, it's just like,
what's a fairy tale? I mean, you know,
It's a great cryptid movie. It is the best Creature from the Black Lagoon since the Creature from the Black Lagoon. Period. But in terms of, it's
no Humanoids from the Deep. But
no, but my wife Marge is not going to sit through Humanoids from the
Deep. No.
Ever. okay, so here's the ones I'd recommend to you. Out of the current batch, the more recent movies of like the last 10 years, I pulled four that I'm going to recommend to you.
Okay.
Abominable, which if you have not seen, it's a great little suspense horror film that hinges on a Sasquatch. It's basically Hitchcock's Rear Window with Sasquatch.
Wow.
Exists, which is my favorite of the found footage Bigfoot movies. And there's a ton of those out there. And I have watched at least 25 of them. And the one that's entitled Exists is the best of the bunch. It actually works quite beautifully. Primal Rage. And let me give you the subtitle as well, because there's a lot of movies called Primal Rage. It's called Primal Rage, Bigfoot Reborn. It's a film by Patrick McGee. The first hour is brilliant, I think. I think it's a brilliant exploitation monster movie. The first hour works like a charm. And then it goes off the rails. It gets really stupid. But it doesn't ruin the power of that first hour, which I've gone back to a couple of times. And I also recommend, if you have the time, and it is an investment of time, the best mini-series that's been done that fits cryptid cinema is the AMC series The Terror. The first season, where it's a self-contained story. That's
based on Simmons' novel, right? I think.
It is a great adaptation of the Dan Simmons novel. And it is, on its own terms, one of the real classics of cryptid cinema. It is a brilliant piece of work.
Nice.
So those four I recommend. I can also recommend, if you're into, now the Wendigo is one of those beings that some people don't consider a cryptid because, you know, it's tied to Native American and First Nation lore. Although, you know, there's entire academic textbooks out there about Wendigo lore and so on. So yeah. I'm not sure where it goes, but it's unusual that we have a single filmmaker, Larry Fessenden, who has done not one, not two, but three variations on the Wendigo. And they are all three completely different from one another. And I recommend watching all three in the order that Larry made them, because okay. they're brilliant. There's his feature called Wendigo, which I actually got to see in a theater. It was when there were still independent art theaters in pockets of New England, and I got to see Wendigo in a theater. And the second one is his feature, The Last Winter, starring Ron Perlman. It's an ecological science fiction thriller, but it is also about Wendigo lore and where it comes from and what it is. And the last one is he did an episode of the TV series Fear Itself. And there's an episode involving Wendigo, a white man who disappears in the wilderness. And when he comes back, he is transformed. This is classic Wendigo case history stuff. So I recommend those three, either back to back or experienced somehow together.
Nice.
There's the art house, you know, then there's the cryptid cinema examples that don't fit at all the kind of exploitation or bad taste of that we're primarily talking about here. But I got to recommend them to people because, you know, cryptid cinema has been around long enough that it has now expanded, as genres do, beyond the parameters of just the little niche that it began in. I recommend The Last Broadcast from 1998.
Yep.
It fascinates me as a film because, yes, it's about the Jersey Devil, but it's not about the Jersey Devil.
right, exactly.
And that's sort of the shell game of the movie. I also
clearly influential on the Blair Witch people. I mean, clearly.
Well, yeah. I mean, not only that, I mean, The Last Broadcast in 1998 is truly the first American feature that was made all digital and projected all digital in a digital theater. It's the first film that did that a year before George Lucas claimed to have done it with The Phantom Menace.
Wow.
A year before the Blair Witch Project came out, right? So Last Broadcast is this incredible pioneer movie. To me, it's the Jazz Singer of the digital age. The Jazz Singer is the film that famously, you know, opened up movies to sound.
Sure.
And to me, The Last Broadcast is that for how we all watch movies today. You know, we go to a theater, and a lot of people don't go to theaters anymore, pandemic aside.
Yeah.
But if you go to a theater, you are watching your films projected digitally. The Last Broadcast was the ground zero of that technology. In fact, the night they first showed it, they were working with Texas Instruments, and no one knew if it was going to work.
Wow.
They were pretty sure it was going to work. They had tested it, and in principle, it should work, but they did not know, is this going to work? Can we download it from a satellite and digitally project it? And it worked. So, okay. And I'm also going to mention The Shape of Water, which I think fits in this, you know. The Shape of Water is sort of the cryptid movie for people who don't like cryptid movies.
Yeah.
Just like I seriously... It's a monster movie for people who don't like monster movies. It's just an amazing movie.
I concur 100%. Yep.
Okay. The other cryptid films I'd recommend that kind of fit that, The Beasts of the Southern Wild. Have you seen that film?
I haven't. Is that the one with the girl and like there's a flood?
Yeah. Down in the Southern Basin, a village that has been essentially wiped out by one of the hurricanes. And it's this little girl who is trying to, you know, make sense of the adult world that she has grown up in, who have basically, they have lost everything to the hurricanes that sweep through states like Louisiana and Mississippi and so on. And she keeps having this vision in her head of these huge prehistoric bison-like creatures that are coming toward them. And it's like cryptozoology as the embodiment of nature. And it's showing what that is in a child's imagination and what it is in the adult world, you know, and that she's not wrong that that's what she sees coming in, because that is how these forces of climate change are operating in the real world, right?
Yeah.
It's a brilliant movie. I've seen a beautiful movie.
The beauty of the cinematography.
It's a ravishing film. And it's also just a wonderful feat of characterization and storytelling. It is truly extraordinary. One of the best independent American films of the last decade. But it is a cryptid movie. And it is a brilliant cryptid movie. There's a movie that got some, you know, buzz when it was first announced, but it is a great film. Sam Elliott in The Man Who Killed Hitler and then Bigfoot.
I love that movie.
It sounds like a gimmick, but it is a terrific movie. And it's a terrific movie that's very relevant to everything we're dealing with in America right now.
Yeah.
Because yes, Bigfoot's in it. And yes, it does involve, I mean, it doesn't lie.
It doesn't lie.
Hitler and then the Bigfoot.
It seems like it's a meditation on aging and on
brotherly love,
on the reality of narrative versus perceived your personal narrative versus the sort of legends that can form around you, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And why I think it's an important film, because we're seeing this play out in really scary ways right now. It's also about how it doesn't matter if something that people believe in is real or not. It also doesn't matter if you kill the human embodiment of an evil, right? He assassinates Hitler, but it doesn't stop.
It doesn't change anything.
Fascism doesn't change anything. And we're having to confront that day in, day out right now in our own culture, right?
Yeah. No, it's
and I won't go into
movie.
It because we're not here to do a political, you know, but that's part of the power of The Man Who Killed Hitler and then the Bigfoot. And it is a brilliantly done film. It's really moving. It's really beautiful. And Sam Elliott gives just a magnificent.
He does. I think maybe his first big role was.
To Frogs, my friend.
Well, he was in Frogs, and there was another movie he was in where he didn't talk, but he was in Legacy was like the first big movie I remember. Well, to me, big.
He goes back to
the Legacy.
I remember Sam. He made some great westerns too in the 80s and 90s.
He's in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in a non-speaking part. Yeah. That's right, Catherine Ross, they're in that movie together, and then they don't get married or anything. Right. And then later they do Legacy together and they do get married. They're still together.
Sam Elliott was one of those character actors initially, sort of like, you know, a more romantic slab of Harry Dean Stanton.
You look back
at early Harry Dean Stanton roles in the 60s, and it's like, man, nobody would have dreamed what he was going to become for us as an actor.
Sam Elliott
is, you know, in a unique path similar to that, went a different way in a different, but this film is, I can't recommend it highly enough.
Yeah. It's a goodie. I totally agree.
There's a really strange one that a lot of people haven't heard of called Letters from the Big Man. Have you heard of that? I have heard of it.
I haven't seen it, but I have definitely heard of it.
You gotta see it. Right.
I remember when it was being produced, the cryptid community was talking all about it.
It's worth seeing. And it is a terrific little movie. And it also expands a whole branch of cryptid cinema, some of which we've already been talking about, you know, the whole interspecies aspect of it, but it takes it in a whole different direction. And it is a wonderful film, really terrific movie. Highly, highly recommend.
That's maybe the only one you've talked about I don't have in my collection. So I should track it.
Better go get it.
Yeah.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies?
Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
We've got a podcast recommendation I think will be really fun and or useful for Monster Talk listeners. I Know Dino, the big dinosaur podcast.
Studying dinosaurs can teach us about the prehistoric world, but also the world of today. For example, migration patterns of dinosaur lineages can tell us about the Earth's changing continents.
Climate models of dinosaur ecosystems help us understand global warming.
Studying dinosaur diets can help show the link between plant and animal evolution.
Talk about paleo. In many dinosaur injuries, paleopathologies are the first known occurrences of diseases.
A new episode of I Know Dino comes out every week with new dinosaur discoveries you won't hear about anywhere else. You can find I Know Dino on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's also a film from the Asian realm. I want to mention three Asian films. Uncle Bunmi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives.
I've heard of that. I don't know why.
Yeah, it's a strange, very lovely ghost story, essentially. But there is a strong cryptid element in it that plays a really key role. And I highly recommend it. It's a really haunting, playful, somber film, and all those three things actually percolate together in the movie. So
nice.
Uncle Bunmi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives.
I'll put links to all this in the show notes. Great. So yeah.
And the other two I'm going to recommend, people have probably seen and didn't think of them as cryptid films. They're both films that got a lot of play here in the States because Bong Joon-ho made them. The first one is The Host, which is one of my all-time favorite Kaiju films.
Mm-hmm.
Arguably not a cryptid, and I get into this in the filmography. There's two filmographies in the back of the second Cryptid Cinema book. One called The Cryptid Cinema Filmography, where I'm proposing a filmography. But with it is the Cryptid Companion Filmography. And this includes films where, if you've seen The Host, it starts like a cryptid movie. There's some sort of bizarre life form that leaps out of the water and is seizing mm-hmm. people. We never quite find out like what made it. It's tied in with some American pharmaceutical firm having a sloppy lab practice that probably spawned it. So it's sort of a mutant movie, which would mean it's not a cryptid. You know, in the way that in cryptozoology, we think about unidentified life forms, but it's I think it's one of the brilliant Kaiju films of all time.
Yeah. No, yeah. And has a lot of interesting family dynamics and humor.
Oh yeah, God. So, yeah. Yeah. There's just some laugh out loud stuff in it. And also some really powerful, wrenchingly sad moments in the film too. And, Bong Joon-ho also made a brilliant movie that I believe is only available on Netflix to watch, which is Okja, O-K-J-A.
Oh, the giant pig.
That is a great cryptid movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, it doesn't quite fit cryptid. When the film starts, it's like classical, you know, cryptid, especially since Gorgo, you know, in 1960-61. This whole bond between children and unidentified creatures that live out there has gone from being kind of a monster movie trope to codified in like the Gamera movies and the later Godzilla movies in the early 70s. And Okja takes it to a whole new level, and it's also just a brilliant slice of satire, and it's a great movie. There's one moment in it where I could not stop laughing, which is there is a one of those city disaster scenes that are so beloved of Kyuju films, and suddenly a John Denver song begins to play on the on the soundtrack, and it is sublime. It is the perfect way of taking that movie to its next level. So those are two odd ones that I would really recommend to anyone who loves cryptid cinema.
Fantastic. These are great recommendations. I'm very excited about this. Thank you so much for spending so much time talking to me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Hopefully we'll do this again.
Yeah, no, for sure. So when the book comes out, when do you think the next one's coming out?
Well, I will keep you posted. And in fact, if you're interested, Blake, I will send you progress on it. I'll make you one of the folks that we send PDFs to.
Oh, I'm definitely interested.
And I'm sure you can see it coming together.
Yeah.
And the way I mean, we're doing it print on demand with Amazon the same way we did the first book. And part of the beauty of that system is you can tweak it. Like we're actually able to print copies, make corrections, make changes.
So this is actually printed by Amazon.
That's print on demand. And
this is fantastic quality.
Oh, yeah. And that book primarily existed and came together the way it did because I was testing the system. If you look through it, I have spiced it with a lot of my original artwork.
Yeah.
And I chose artwork that was done with different tools. So there's grayscale painted artwork. There's wash drawings. There's brush and ink, pen and ink. Because I wanted to see how would it look with the current print-on-demand technology. And it came out looking great. So with the Boggy Creek Bequest, we're doing it in color. We're going to push the envelope in terms of color. We will also make it available in black and white because color books are very expensive.
I was actually going to ask you, what does that do to the per unit cost?
I don't know. So the color edition could be crazy expensive. So what we hope to do is a color hardcover edition for the real connoisseurs, a color paperback edition, and then a black and white edition, or we may break it into two black and white editions. So the people that just want to read about Legend of Boggy Creek can get the one book in black and white, very affordably priced, around $21.
Yeah.
And volume two would be the second half of Boggy Creek Bequest, focuses on some of the films that came after. I do a full interview with Sean Whiteley, the man who directed Southern Fried Bigfoot, which is my favorite of all the documentaries that followed what Charles Pierce did. And I watched hundreds of them. I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah, well, I know they exist.
And I did a full career-length film-by-film interview with Seth Breedlove covering the entire Small Town Monsters filmography.
Yeah, nice.
Because to me, what Sean did with Southern Fried Bigfoot and what Seth and Mark and all the people that are part of the Small Town Monsters team have done is they've taken the trail that Charles Pierce blazed in 1972 and they've brought it to the next level in the 21st century.
I agree. I would agree very much so. I've met Seth a few times
and the films are great. Yeah. And if I were to recommend only one more movie, my all-time favorite Small Town Monster movie, the one I would recommend to anybody to watch and that I would add to the essential cryptid cinema list, is Momo, the Missouri Monster. It is a
I love the setup for that. I love the setup. Yeah. So for the listeners, that's the he's basically set it up as though it's like a lost episode of something that never got released, but they're going to let it. But now you're going to get to see what they did with this. And it's about one of the strangest real Bigfoot cases out there. So,
yep. And it's what they did is they not only had the conceit of let's manufacture a 1970s film that never existed, they also bring in Lyle Blackburn,
and Lyle as the movie
a real cryptozoologist. Lyle is narrating the meta.
Yeah, it's very layered.
The actual interviews with the actual survivors of the people who were in the community where the Momo sightings happened, with the fictional film that Lyle is the TV
host for. Yeah,
it is like a brilliant autopsy of the entirety of cryptid.
It's more layered than a fancy cake. It's very layered, right? It's very great. Layered.
And it's a lot of fun, which is even more important with a fancy cake. Does it taste good? It tastes great.
Yeah, right. I'm not saying it's nutritious, but you'll enjoy it, right?
It's very nutritious, actually. So you know, that's that. I think we could break if Cryptid Cinema, The Boggy Creek Bequest, the second volume, ends up being too big. We're going to release it as what it is, but we're also going to break it into possibly two less expensive volumes, so that people that just want to read the Legend of Boggy Creek stuff can buy that black and white volume, and the people that want to read the legacy stuff, which primarily is composed of those interviews with contemporary filmmakers, that would also be a more affordable black and white volume. We're going to play with what's possible. Part of the fun of print on demand is, you know, you can do things that no publisher would ever allow you to do.
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. And I'm very interested in all that. I've been following print on demand since it really got started. And you know, I've got a couple of books in the work myself.
You should be doing it. I mean, really, it's the first time that the gatekeeper has been removed. And I still work with publishers, right? I'm about right. We're in the middle of contracting right now on a big graphic novel project that if it happens, will be done with a mainstream publisher. I still work with publishers. My Brood book, which came out last year, you know, this was done with two imprints, Electric Dream House, which has a series called The Midnight Movie Monographs, and PS Publishing, and they're based in the United Kingdom. So I'm still working with publishers, but the fun of doing these books is Tim Paxton and I can make these books into precisely what we want them to be.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah.
So, and no, for the authors like yourself, Blake, if you were to interest a publisher in one of your book projects, you'd get a little tiny advance.
Exactly.
Maybe something on the back end.
And then be responsible for all the public.
And you got to do everything anyway.
I get to all the PRs.
Whereas, print on demand with Amazon, when you recommend it to your friends to go and buy a Cryptid Cinema, every month ends with a little money going into my bank account from whatever sold the month.
Nice. That's wonderful.
I don't have to wait 6 months or a year for the trickle down royalty.
Yes. Yeah. You don't have to go audit.
Amazon puts it right in the bank account. And my experiment with Cryptid Cinema was twofold. If I put a book out there and don't promote it at all, will people buy it? I've done almost no promo on Cryptid Cinema. I do a little bit when it first came out. And if I take the period out of my middle name, right, it's Stephen R. Bissette, but if I take the period out, if people go on Amazon and buy Swamp Thing, it doesn't take them to Cryptid Cinema. I was curious, could I sell a book if it wasn't associated with Swamp Thing?
Yeah.
And by taking the period out of my name, it did it.
Nice.
Any sales I get on Cryptid Cinema is because of Cryptid Cinema. It's not because you bought all the Swamp Things and Cryptid Cinema popped up on the Amazon feed, because it doesn't, because it's Stephen R. with a period on all my mainstream books. It's R. without a period on Cryptid Cinema, which is, you know, sort of a suicidal, stupid thing to do. But it was also a test. I wanted to see what would happen. So.
Well, hopefully you'll get a few more bucks from talking with me. So
I hope so, please. And thank you for buying a copy. And I hope you enjoyed it. It was mainly meant to be a fun, pleasurable read.
It was like the best present for me that I didn't know I was giving myself. You know what I mean?
There
like,
you go.
I mean, it was such a delight. I loved it. So, and I'm sure the audience will love it too. I've been like, see, for the bonus material for our bonus, I call it big footage. Is the
way? That's the way to go.
Yeah, it's just all Bigfoot movies, and that's just something that I do for the patrons special. But I just love it. I'm proud to have this on the shelf and look forward to the other volumes. Now I'm going to do something that's unfair to you, which is
that's all right. Bring it on.
I didn't prepare you for this because I didn't know how long we're going to get to talk.
But it's okay.
In the typical Monster Talk interview, we end with our signature question, and that is the completely unfair question. You're going to hate me.
Okay.
What's your favorite monster?
Oh, that's easy.
Oh, is
it? My favorite monster? The creature from the Black Lagoon.
Awesome. Okay.
My absolute favorite monster.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, like, my favorite monster should be a Ray Harryhausen monster, because you know, the formative experience in my life was seeing beasts from 20,000 fathoms on TV when I was like four.
Yeah.
But for some reason, the Gill Man just like captured me when I was a kid.
It's a good costume. It holds up lovely.
It's not just the costume. It's like he became this weird surrogate me, this weird projection of, you know, my primal self. Like when I'd be angry when I was a kid, you know, I wished I was the Gill Man. or if I was in the woods and I was just like tearing through the woods when I was five and six, it's like I was the Gill Man.
You know? Wow.
I don't know what it was. It was like this really primal instinctive thing. I think part of it might be, you know, growing up in the part of New England I grew up in northern Vermont, we weren't allowed to have pets when I was a kid. Right? Because my mom and my dad had both come from families that had, you know, 12 living brothers and sisters. And my mom grew up on a farm and pets just were like vermin to them. So we didn't have a dog. We didn't have a cat. So, you know, going out every spring, getting frogs' eggs, bringing them home, putting them in an aquarium, nursing them through tadpole, letting them go when they were frogs. So I think the frog thing was part of it for me, you know, because that was the only living life form that I had that kind of regular relationship with.
Yeah.
That was real, you know, that wasn't imaginary, that was real. Yeah. And I was that kind of kid, you know, I was the kid that picked up the rocks and what's under the rocks.
Yeah. Yeah.
My brother and I caught painted turtles and we actually, you know, built this big pen in the backyard and raised painted turtles.
Nice.
That whole year they laid eggs, you know. So I think the creature, the Gill Man, you know, kind of, it was the fantasy aspect projection of those bonds I felt with nature as a kid, with primarily amphibians and reptiles that were around us in the natural environment. And I think part of it was there were no, like, there's no venomous reptiles in Vermont. Like, we didn't have to be afraid of the snakes.
Well, that is nice.
I guess rattlesnakes have been found on Camel's Hump in one other location, but, you know, they weren't around. So I wasn't afraid of them. And that also meant the creature was like, you know, my buddy.
Nice. That is fantastic.
And he is still the monster I most love to draw. You know, if you're on my Facebook page, you know, the two monsters I draw the most and put up sketches of on my Facebook page would be Swamp Thing, because that's what people want me to draw. But the creature is the one I love to draw, you know.
That's great. Well, that's so a great answer. Yeah.
Well, and it also ended up tying into all the things I ended up loving growing up, you know, Lovecraft.
Oh yeah.
It was plugged right into there. You know, I remember Dad and Mom taking us to see The Incredible Mr. Limpet with Don Knotts.
Oh, I love that movie. Yeah.
You know, a guy that wants to turn into a fish. Hey, that was me, right?
That one in The Ghost of Mr. Chicken. I don't know why
I love The Ghost of Mr. Chicken, you know. But I think it's part of the reason Shape of Water hits such a deep reservoir for me. It was like that was the creature movie I always wished existed, and now it does. And
that's awesome.
I don't see any downside to it, you know.
Well, so I have to end this. Let's do it as though, because there's going to be a short version of this for the conference.
So you can do whatever you want with all this. We haven't done anything that anybody would object to.
No, I don't think so. Not at all. No, I think people are going to love this. So let's, on behalf of the Adventures in Poor Taste Sci-Fi Fest, I want to say thank you for taking time to talk to us. This has been great.
My great pleasure.
On behalf of Monster Talk, I absolutely love this conversation. Thank you so much. We will definitely have to have you back on.
Yeah, now, my great pleasure.
So normally I have a co-host. I don't know why I'm doing this. She lives in Denver. I live in Georgia. But anyway, my co-host, Dr. Karen Stolzno, would normally be a part of this. So,
Let's do that sometime.
Yeah. We'll have to have her. She would dig this. This would be great. So
great.
It was really wonderful talking to you. Obviously, you love this stuff at least as much as me, if not way more. So that's great. So
I may have a few years of love up on you.
I'll earn into it. Give me time. So.
Blake, this has been great.
Likewise.
Thanks for inviting me in. I'm really glad that Russ suggested it. And we'll do the Q&A on the day, right?
Sounds like it. Yeah, that's exciting. Great. All right.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzno.
You just heard an interview with artist and author Stephen R. Bissett about his book, Cryptid Cinema. The book is available on Amazon, and there's a link to that in the show notes. Two more volumes are planned, and I'm looking forward to those with great interest. I really enjoyed this book, and I enjoyed my interview with Steve, and I hope you did too. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. If you enjoyed this discussion of movies, you might also like my show, The Horror Podcast. I don't put out episodes very often, but it is a fun show about horror in all its guises. Plus, I believe it's probably the only podcast that digs in on the question at the front of everyone's mind. Sure, that was a great horror film, but how is it related to Star Trek? Well, tune in and find out.
Been a Monster House presentation.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business?
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.